Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending some time with me this hour. First, we want to note to our listeners, our next segment discusses sexual assault and might be difficult for some people to hear. If you feel at any time you need support, please call the National Sexual Assault Hotline. The number is 1-800-656-HOPE. That's 1-800-656-4673. From 2005 to 2009, more than 100 women and girls of the Bolivian Mennonite colony of Manitoba were attacked by what they thought were demons in the night. At least that was the only conclusion that seemed to explain why they'd wake up some mornings with splitting headaches, pain in their genitals, blood and semen on their sheets, and barely any recollection of what had happened to them. Until one day, two men were caught trying to enter their neighbor's home at night, and the truth became clear. Ultimately, nine Mennonite men confessed to using a belladonna spray to anesthetize the women of their colony and rape them. The demons were real, and they were friends, family, brothers, and fathers. This horrific event, known to history as the Bolivian Ghost Rapes, serves as the inspiration for the author Miriam Tave's new novel, Women Speaking. Miriam, who was raised in a Mennonite community herself, creates a fictional account of Mennonite women meeting to discuss what to do in the aftermath of the attacks. Do they stay? And as the elders have commanded them to forgive the men, do they stay and fight, which is against their pacifist religion? Or do they leave the only home they know behind? Written in the form of quote-unquote minutes taken by a sympathetic male narrator, Women Talking presents a searing chorus of women finding their voices. Miriam will be speaking at the Strand tonight in conversation with Frances McDormand, Judith Thurman, and Dee Dee Gardner. And she joins us in studio now. Miriam, welcome to All of It.
Thank you very much.
And you're very excited to meet Frances because she's attached to the film version.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan. Yeah, yes. It's very exciting.
That's a yes, yes. It's very exciting. Yeah. So when you sat down to write this, given all the information I've just given our listeners, and many people remember the story, what was the story that you wanted to tell, and really what was your goal?
When I heard about these rapes, I had many questions that I guess I've been having for a while now, because of, you know, just having been raised in a similar community, a conservative Mennonite community. But these questions were different. It you hear about this, and I was horrified, like everybody else, when they heard about these rapes. But to be honest with you, I wasn't surprised. Sort of being familiar with this culture, and I wanted to ask myself these questions. I wanted to have my characters asking these questions about basically, you know, what do we do now? Mm-hmm. How do we deal with this? How do we respond? How do we heal? How do we prevent this from happening again? And basically, so the book is a fictionalized response to these rapes. And I didn't want to go into the details of the rapes. That it wasn't my intention to reenact these scenes. So I knew that it would be, you know, the aftermath, that the book would be, that the content of the book would be the aftermath to the rapes.
Can you describe the colony? What are some of the most important rules and conventions?
Mm-hmm. I mean, these colonies, these Mennonite colonies are like similar to other fundamentalist communities, patriarchal, authoritarian, and like I say, fundamentalist, which includes the inherent misogyny, basically a fundamentalism of that literal interpretation of the scripture. Mm-hmm. So that the women are not given a voice. The women are there to serve the men. The incidents of domestic assault, sexual violence, etc., incest are high in these isolated colonies. The women are they don't speak. They're not educated. They're not literate. They don't speak the language of the country that they're in. They have no means of getting off the or out of the colony without being accompanied by a man, father, husband, etc. So when these types of things happen, and they're self-policed communities, right, in a sense, or not even policed, but it is the male leader, self-governed, authority, and of course, sanctioned by God, the ultimate authority, within their belief system. And so, there's no recourse for these women when these things happen. There's nowhere for them to go. When they do talk about it, they're not believed, or it's denied. So essentially, the women and the girls in these types of communities are prisoners in a way.
When you were writing this book, what did you think the fictionalized account could accomplish that straight journalism couldn't account? What did you see as you that you could do?
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are truths that only fiction can achieve, or it can. So it's kind of for me. I mean, I am a novelist, so when I hear something, even though it's based on a true story, my instinct is to create narrative around that, characters, and a story. So I could, I could maybe create characters that. I was very conscious of showing, portraying these women as real human beings. It's so easy to dismiss these people in these types of communities as freaks and, mm-hmm. cultists, and then to ignore the stuff that's happening, because it seems kind of in another world, and I really was conscious of that, and I wanted to show that these are, women like human beings who joke and who laugh and who attack each other, who criticize each other, who contradict themselves, who are intelligent, who can, and so I think fiction allows something like that, basically, to create character and that kind of tension.
And there are some chuckles. I mean, there's some very funny passages. Were you consciously providing us, the reader, a little relief, or did that go to your point you just made that people are multidimensional?
Yeah, I feel about about humor. It's not something that I intentionally try and put into my writing. It's for me, it's kind of this organic thing. It's the way that I see the world. I see the world as it's a tragic place. It's an absurd place. It's a funny place. And and these women are no different. Obviously, they've been traumatized. They've been violated. And there's an urgency and to what they're doing and such a seriousness. Because it's dangerous. Mm-hmm. Every choice that they have is dangerous and high stakes. But within all of that, the idea of cracking a joke or finding humor in something or the need to laugh, I think is such an essential part of any kind of group, like mm-hmm. when you get together, it's not something the humor isn't. Distraction or a relief, like you say, from the darker material and the stuff that they're dealing with. It's just another way of presenting it.
My guest is Miriam Taves. The name of her new book is Woman Talking. So you set out, you have this chorus of women. Whose voice came to you first?
I was thinking about the women. I was thinking about how I would create these characters. I really based them, each character, on somebody that I know, on the Mennonite women that I know, my mother, mm-hmm. sister, grandparents, friends, etc. And I think it was probably Salome's voice. She kind of expresses that type of that initial rage. The mm-hmm. rage when you hear about this stuff. That rage, that anger, that how could this have happened? How is this possible? And so that was my initial feeling when I heard about it. And so it's Salome who expresses all of that. So she would have been the first voice that kind of came to me.
The title's obviously Women Talking, but we have this male narrator. Why did you want to include that? What was the purpose of having a male narrator rather than have these women?
When I decided that the content of the book would be the minutes of these meetings, that's something that's written down, and the women don't read or write.
They wouldn't know how to, right?
Basically, yeah, exactly. And also, there's a control not only of their minds and their spirit, within that community, but also and of their bodies. Obviously, every aspect of their person and intellect is controlled. And so, yeah, so, you know, reading and writing is a dangerous thing, and they're not taught. But for them. So it would necessarily, you know, there would have to be a man writing this down. But more importantly, you know, the fact that August is in the loft taking these minutes, it was an act of compassion, really, on mm-hmm. Ona's part. Ona's another one of the women considered to be a kind of non-entity in this community, that she's lost her mind and therefore is, you know, of no
she has consequence. It's called Narfa,
yeah, exactly, nerves, you know, and of course as a result of, you know, too, of the rapes. And so she says, and she understands August and loves August, and August loves her, a special kind of, you know, unique mm-hmm. love. And she says, as a gesture of compassion and kindness and friendship to him, sensing that he is suffering, that in fact he's suicidal, she says, August, you know, you've been left behind. You're not considered man enough to go with the other men to the city. You know, you come with us. You'll be safe with us women in the loft. Just stay with us. And she kind of offhandedly gives him this task of taking the minutes. Here's a task for you, something that you can do while we're very busy, you know, figuring out, deciding, planning, thinking what we're going to do. And it's that inversion of roles as well. As the women philosophize and plan and take action, he is there to sit and to listen and to learn and to record, you know, as a secretary would normally. And in the end, the minutes are irrelevant anyway. And August has choices to make, and he has to decide what he's going to do. Mm-hmm. And the women have already decided what they're going to do, and the hope is that they will go on to write their own stories.
Well, it's interesting. In the very beginning of the book, they seem to have three options: do nothing, stay and fight, and leave. And part of the discussion is, what does each of those mean? And mm-hmm. Since you brought up Ona, there's this part where she describes how the elders say they don't really need counseling after right. this. Mm-hmm. What is this counseling? Yeah. So I was going to ask you to read this passage because I think it's really interesting. This is Miriam Taves reading from her book, Women Talking.
If it has been decided by the elders and the bishop of Malachna that we women don't require counseling following these attacks because we weren't conscious when they happened, then what are we obliged or even able to forgive? Something that didn't happen? Something that we are unable to understand? And what does that mean more broadly? If we don't know the world, we won't be corrupted by it. If we don't know that we are imprisoned, then we are free.
It's interesting, the idea of them being so secluded and so detached that they're not even allowed to feel they have to question everything about, did this actually happen? Do we mm-hmm. get to feel this? Do we have counseling? The elders say we don't. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in why these women are in your book, given that was their life, would even consider leaving.
Mm-hmm. Again, I mean, they're desperate. They have been so harmed, and so systemically harmed, mm-hmm. and you know, over the years, and not just by these egregious acts, these rapes, but also just again within that culture, and not only their bodies, but like I said before, you know, their intellects, their psyches, collectively have been so harmed, and I think that for them, I mean, none of the choices is easy. None of the choices comes without pain, loss, sorrow, and uncertainty. So, you know, the idea of leaving, of course, would be something that would be unthinkable in a way until they begin to discuss, you know, what it would entail. I mean, they don't have a map. They don't know where they are in the world. They mm-hmm. don't know in which direction to, if they were to leave, which direction they would go. And that is, you know, of course, you know, because of, you know, the nature of these colonies, that they're closed and that they're basically imprisoned within these colonies. And so for them to think about any of this is radical. But again, to stay, you know, means that they're putting themselves in harm's way, and they want to protect their children. They want to keep their children safe, but they also want to keep their faith. This is very important. And, mm-hmm. and everything that they decide and everything that they talk about is within the context of their faith. so it's just high stakes with it, you know, in terms of any choice that they make. And of course, to stay and fight, you know, has its own problems within a pacifist community. And of course, just the sort of impossibility of that too strikes them. You know, how are they to fight against these men? And so it's a difficult, fraught discussion that they're having.
It's also a very interesting, there's very part of it, the discussion between the difference between fleeing and leaving, mm-hmm. and having them having different meanings. Mm-hmm. If you flee versus I'm leave, like the mm-hmm. ownership of leaving mm-hmm. versus running away from something.
Yeah, and they use that, and they, you know, all of their sort of analogies and metaphors and, you know, examples of comparisons are all based on their own experiences. So a lot of them have to do with animals or with nature. You know, mm-hmm. are they rats fleeing a burning building? You know, what does that say about their dignity? What does that say about their agency? Can they not choose to do something and then do it? Will they, leaving is something that, you know, it's a conscious thought out, measured decision, in a sense, at least for these women within this context. But fleeing, in their minds, is something that, you know, would is an action that comes just you know, from absolute fear you know, it's not something that they consciously would decide to do. It would be an instinct and to save themselves, and they really do want to come to a decision that involves thinking through, you know, that involves their intellect, that involves reason, and so, you know, the idea of fleeing has no part in that.
My guest is Miriam Taves. The name of her book is Women Talking. When did you write this?
When did I write it?
Yes.
I wrote it.
You know, I'm going to ask you.
Yes, exactly. I wrote it and completed it before the Me Too movement began, if that's what the question is. I understand how it fits into that conversation for sure. But the reality is that I finished it before the Me Too, at least this iteration of the Me Too movement began in 2017. I finished it in 2016, actually at the end of 2015.
That's interesting. There's another, we had another guest who had a similar story. I'm just wondering if maybe you creative folks are just, you're sort of prescient, like your antenna is just up or something. I just think it's so interesting.
Coincidence.
We mentioned earlier about, you know, this is a violent act. And in the novel, you allude to some of the difficulties in the aftermath, a child with an STD, who is pregnant with someone who raped her. I'm curious about, did you always know from the beginning you weren't going to concentrate on the violence, that it was just going to be aftermath?
I didn't always know. I think at the very beginning, and again, you know, like I was saying before, that initial feeling where you just feel such rage, sorrow, heartbreak, it's such a visceral emotional feeling, and the idea of revenge plays into that as well. You know, what can, like, to, yeah, and then, you know, as I thought more about it and thought about how I would write the book and what it was that I wanted to accomplish with the book, you know, I realized that kind of revenge scenario wasn't for me. It wasn't something that, I mean, revenge only, you know, generates more mm-hmm. Violence and bitterness. And so that wasn't something that I wanted to explore, but and not in myself, in my own spirit and soul, and also not in our mind and also not within my characters in the book. So then I you know, it became very, very clear to me that I didn't want to, also to dwell on the violence, like you say, like the details, the horrible, harsh details of the, there's a foreword at the beginning mm-hmm. of the book that states, you know, like basically the bare bone kind of, you know, facts as we know them from this story. But
I found that so helpful because it just took care of that, mm-hmm. you yeah, know, in the yeah. sense like, okay, I have my facts. Mm-hmm. I know what I need to know. Mm-hmm. Now let me go into mm-hmm. this world.
And you can see that the characters, I mean, they have, you can see the results of this, like you say, you know, the STDs, the pregnancies, the madness. The Sua character has committed suicide. The pain and the heartbreak, the bewilderment. How could the trauma that affects them all? And I think that, you know, it is sort of from time to time comes up in their conversation, or at least is alluded to.
You were raised in a Mennonite community. why did it feel like an okay time to tackle this story for you? And I'm curious the kind of internal conversations you had.
Yeah, I feel as though I have been fighting patriarchal violence all of my life, really, literally, from day one. First of all, within my own conservative Mennonite community, and also in my work and in my writing. I think just about all of my work deals with that and my position within it. I have questions. I am a Mennonite. This is my community. This is my culture. And you can think it's my family in a sense. I feel obligated to, I want to, I need to for my own sake, question some of this stuff and the authority, basically that hierarchy, that culture of control that has created so much damage, so much harm, guilt, shame, punishment, silencing of women. And I've seen it firsthand. I suppose I'll always be, addressing that in some way, searching always continuously for my place within that community, because that is who I am and where I belong. But again, I have so many questions, and I feel that we can be self-critical. We can talk about the problems within our within our Mennonite community, and hopefully and I know that I'm not alone. I know that there are so many people. This is just one book and just one thing that's talking about this stuff, and it's a novel, and there are so many people on the ground, Mennonites, non-Mennonites, people in Bolivia, people in Canada, in the States, who are talking about these types of things, these issues that are happening in these communities, in these closed colonies, and trying to address them, and even people who are getting together to pray. And I respect that. I all the readings that I do, there are always Mennonites at the readings. Not only Mennonites, but we've been talking about this since 2009, basically. Do you know what happened in the Manitoba colony in Bolivia? Yeah, this has happened. What are we going to do? What are you going to do? What am I going to do? What are we going to do? I'm so moved by that kind of response by, it's mostly Mennonite women, but men too, obviously, who are part of that and attempting to, to at least think about this and to bring it into the open, So again, it's always a conflict. There's so much rage and heartbreak that I can go to in my mind when I think about my community. But there's also so much love and honest, genuine attempt to follow the faith, to follow the tenets of the faith. Pacifism and kind of community, compassion, forgiveness, all of those beautiful tenets of the faith that are there, that do exist, And again, I've said so many times that in my work that it's not the Mennonite faith or the Mennonite people that I'm critical of or that I'm, right. It's that fundamentalism. It's that culture of control. I guess I'll continue doing that. This conversation that I was having last night with Meg Wolitzer, this idea that we write about the same things over and over and over again, I think that's very true in my case. Same idea.
The name of the novel is Women Talking. It's by Miriam Taves. She will be in conversation tonight at 7 p.m. at The Strand with Judith Thurman, Dee Dee Gardner, and Frances McDormand. Miriam, thank you so much for joining us on All of It today. It was a pleasure meeting you.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
This is All of It on WNYC.